I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, the Darkness have a new album out, The Last of Our Kind, and they're ready to kick off the Blast of Our Kind world tour in America and Canada next Friday, October 9th. First stop, the Glass House in Pomona, just outside of Los Angeles. And today, crazy man singer Justin Hawkins joins TIJ, and he is every bit the crazy rock and roll frontman you think he might be. Wait till you hear his philosophy on critics and reviews and his argument and idea to change his band's name, like now. He wants to change the name. Yeah, exactly. He's also talking about his infamous cat suit, riding a giant penis over top of the audience, his love of Queen, the band's new drummer Rufus Tiger Taylor, who happens to be the son of Queen drummer Roger Taylor, and touring with Lady Gaga, the reactions they got and didn't get. And if that's not enough rock and roll for you, I also got Brian Slagle, the CEO of Metal Blade Records and one of the architects of the early version of Metallica. He's sharing stories about Metallica's Cliff Burton here on just after the 29th anniversary of Cliff's untimely passing. Brian was kind of like the fifth member of early Metallica, in a way that George Martin was like the fifth member of the Beatles. He actually helped get Cliff into Metallica. So lots of rock talk today. Lots of rock and roll coming.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pod of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and it's Friday. How awesome is that? Today's show, Justin Hawkins from The Darkness actually has written a song called Friday. So it's perfect. It's a new Friday into the pantheon of Talk is Jericho Fridays. Hey, man, today's Justin Hawkins episode is going to be amazing, and it's brought to you by Burger King. And that's right. Right now at Burger King, get the new extra long jalapeno cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger. Feel the flame with two all beef patties stacked with spicy jalapeno peppers. Now part of the $2 for $5 deal only at Burger King. Limited time only. Restrictions apply. You got to go try it out. Taste it, taste it. All right. Justin Hawkins from The Darkness here today. But also, I told you guys on last episode that I went and saw AC/DC. At Dodger Stadium, Los Angeles. And while I was in LA, I went down to Metal Blade Records and hung out with my buddy Brian Slagle, the CEO of Metal Blade Records. He created Metal Blade way back in 1981 when he started the Metal Massacre compilation. A good friend of his that he had just met called Lars Ulrich had asked him if he can have a spot in that compilation. And that's how Brian and Lars became friends. In an early version of Metallica. Brian was there when Dave Mustaine was in the band. Brian was there when Ron McGovney was in the band, the original bass player. And when they decided to get rid of Ron, Brian tipped Lars and James off to Cliff Burton, one of the greatest bass players of all time and a true early pioneer and architect of Metallica. Helped Metallica become what they are on their first three records, Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, Master of Puppets. They were riding high. Cliff was on top of the world when he was killed in a tragic bus accident on September 27th, 1986. I remember that time. I remember exactly what happened. I'm going to talk about it with Brian. Here we are, just passing the 29th anniversary of that sad, sad day. So in tribute to Cliff Burton, one of my all-time rock and roll heroes, and kind of an enigma, he was taken far too soon. Not a lot of people knew Cliff, but Brian Slagle did know Cliff. Here's my conversation and the memories of Cliff Burton with Brian Slagle. Okay, so after 30 years of being a fan of Metal Blade Records, I finally get to come to Metal Blade offices with the CEO, Brian Slagle, is here. And it's cool to be. This is a pretty prestigious office in here, man.
Well, this is our B office. The main office is a different one, but this is the B kind of meeting, hanging out by the beach office.
Okay, so this is like your guest house.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The beach house.
Yeah, the beach house, right, because you can actually see the beach from here.
You can actually see the beach, yeah.
But it's really poignant because I was thinking the other day, it was September 27th or 26th, 27th, 2015, the 29th anniversary of the death of Cliff Burton.
Which is crazy it's been that long.
Unbelievable.
It's like insane.
You know, and the thing is, you've been involved, like I kind of say in a lot of ways, you know, George Martin was the fifth member of the Beatles or Brian Epstein. You were kind of like the fifth member of Metallica in the early days of the band in helping Metallica begin and kind of getting their first deal on Metal Massacre and all that sort of thing. And being a lifelong Cliff Burton fanatic, I wanted to talk to you about Cliff because you knew him fairly well.
Yep.
And one of the few guys that can actually say that, and you know it's true.
Yeah, it's a kind of a funny, well, all these stories are kind of funny how they, when you look back at how these things happened. But I got a tape from a band in San Francisco called Trauma for Metal Massacre 2 after we put out Metal Massacre 1.
So you put out Metal Massacre just cause kind of like an indie thing and got a bunch of bands that were in the area, put them on the album.
The real quick story was I was working at a record label. I'm sorry, working at a record shop. There were no record labels back then.
But there were record shops.
Yes.
There's no record shops now.
Not anymore. So I was working there and I was bringing in all the new wave of British heavy metal stuff. And then somebody said, hey, you know, there's some good bands playing around LA. I'm like, really? So one of the first shows I saw was Troubadour Wednesday night for a dollar, Motley Crue and Rat.
For a dollar
on a Wednesday night.
Holy smokes, man.
So I just, you know, these bands were playing in LA and nobody knew that they existed. Nobody cared. So I was kind of, I thought, well, to give them some sort of exposure, kind of based on the new wave of British heavy metal and the do-it-yourself attitude, I was like, well, maybe I'll just put together a compilation album of local LA heavy metal bands. And so, long story short, I ended up doing it, putting it out. Motley Crue was supposed to be on it, by the way, and they dropped out at the last second because I had actually helped them get distribution for their album.
No kidding.
That's a whole nother story. Yeah, there are two managers, these guys, Kaufman and Kaufman, came to my mom's house, sat on the couch, and said, hey, we made up 900 Motley Crue records. What do we do with them? I said, oh, you should take them to the distributor down there, and they'll help you. If I only knew then what I knew now, right?
Yeah.
But so the record came out, and then, you know, my friend Lars, who I'd known for a while because we were both big music fans and hung out, said, hey, if I put together a band, can I be on your record? I'm like, yeah, sure. So that, of course,
ended up being Metallica. Can I have a spot on your record? Do you have a band?
Yep.
Nobody will find one, basically?
Well, it was him and James were just kind of hanging out playing, and they couldn't find anybody else to play in the band because at that point, you know, LA was kind of getting a little more, you know, poppy. So they didn't do anything, and they stopped kind of hanging out and rehearsing. So Lars, when I put together this compilation on me, thought, oh, this is the way to get with James. Because back in 1982, being on a record was a big deal. I mean,
sure.
Now, you know, everybody's on a record. But back then, it was not that simple. So Lars went to James and said, hey, if we put together a song, we can be on this compilation album my friend's putting out. I said, okay. So the first version of Hit the Lights was just Lars and James, and James's guitar teacher, Lloyd Grant, played the lead. And the other
guy
two
with
played
the
big
everything. Dreadlocks,
yep, yep. So I put out that record, and it did pretty well, and all of a sudden people started to, you know, say, hey, we want to be on your record. I started getting tons and tons of demos and bands wanting to be on it. And one of those bands was this band from San Francisco called Trauma. And their bass player, of course, was Cliff Burton. So I had never talked to anybody in the band. They had a management company that had kind of spent some money to do the demo. And they brought them to L.A. to play at, again, the Troubadour, which was kind of the spot back then. And I saw them. And the band was okay, but the bass player was incredible. So I was like, wow, this guy's really good.
So what kind of a band were they? Just like a typical stock rock band?
Pretty typical early 80s kind of semi-European influenced metal band.
So what's Cliff doing to just blow your mind?
Well, it was weird because the band were all disjointed. Like the singer looked one way, the guitar player's looking another way, the drummer. But Cliff was this commanding presence on stage, as you see him afterwards.
Right.
You know, same look. Big, you know, bell bottoms and the denim jacket.
Teenage mustache.
Looked completely different from everybody else in the band. And was just headbanging crazy.
And that's the thing, quickly, Cliff Burton at that time, like, you know, bell bottoms and the one length long hair, the plaid, like nobody dressed like that. Like in 1985, 86, you know, 84, heavy metal hair was the bangs, cut at the eyes, leather, tight jeans. And here's a guy with bell bottoms. He looked like he was like from 1969.
Totally. But he commanded that stage. Mm. I was like, wow, this guy's really good. And like I said, the band was eh, but he was amazing. So as fate would have it, a couple, two, three, 4 weeks later, hanging out with Lars, and Lars said, hey, I think we're going to make a change for our bass player. I was like, really? I love Ron. Ron's a great guy. Ron McGovney was the original bass player. But those guys were getting better musically, and Ron was not quite getting keeping there as they were making new material, especially when Mustaine got in the band because he was really good. So he said, you know, we're going to make a change. Do you know anybody? I said, ah, it's funny you should ask. So you guys should come because Trauma had set up another show at the Troubadour in L.A. for maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks after I talked to Lars, about 2 months after the first time I saw them. And this is after the Metal Masquer record had come out. So I said, you guys should come see this band Trauma because their bass player is really good. He's like, all right. So here we go. 2, 3 weeks later, Trauma plays the Troubadour. Lars and James are both there. And maybe 15 minutes into, or maybe even less, 10 minutes into Trauma set, Lars leans over and says, that guy's going to be in my band. Like, okay, whatever you say, Lars. But when Lars says something, you know, even today, it usually happens.
Makes it happen, yeah.
It's amazing. So sure enough, they talked to him right after the show, and he was a little bit like, eh, you know. I mean, he was kind of the main guy. I think it was him and the singer were the two main guys in that band. He's like, eh, I don't really know. But they kept on him and just kept on him and on him and on him. And eventually they kind of wore him down, I think. And he's like, all right, well, sure. If you guys move to San Francisco, I'm in.
So they moved to San Francisco specifically to get Cliff.
It's exactly what they did. But, you know, they were in L.A. They were definitely not. The scene in L.A. was getting much more Motley Crue rat pop sort of stuff. And Metallica was, nobody knew what to make of them. They were super heavy and they played mostly, you know, punk covers and, you know, Motorhead and Diamondhead covers. And people had no idea what to make of them.
Yeah.
So they weren't really getting a response here. And I had done a Metal Masquer show in San Francisco. And it was Bitch, Metallica, and Sir Thungle was supposed to go, and they bagged out at the last minute, so some horrible local band played in San Francisco. But when Metallica got to San Francisco, people went nuts. Mm. I mean, that show was, there were probably 200, 250 people there, and they went crazy for Metallica, unlike anything they had seen in L.A. So them moving to San Francisco wasn't kind of just, well, we're, you know, we're doing this out of the blue. They'd been there a couple of times. They started to have a bit of a following up there, and way better than they had here. And you know, those guys had nothing to lose to go up there. So
what was it for Cliff to finally join Metallica, do you think? Did he see something there?
I think once he saw them play up in San Francisco and kind of saw there's something happening here, and with Trauma, you know, he was a smart guy. And with Trauma, you know, they kind of had a little bit going on, but not nearly what Metallica had going on. And just in terms of playing shows and having the reaction for the kids. Because, you know, at that time, nobody had anything going on, really.
Right.
But I think he saw that and saw there was a potential, but he did not want to leave San Francisco. So I think, I mean, we kind of talked about this, and he never really said it. But I think in the back of my mind, he just thought that, I'll just tell them, you've moved to San Francisco and I'll be in your band, thinking that they would never do it.
Right.
And sure enough, they did.
It's the classic thing. If you don't want to do something, just give some ridiculous price.
Exactly.
You know, pay me $1 million and I'll do it. All right, there's $1 million.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's how it works. So what was Cliff like as a guy? Did you know him fairly well? Did you ever hang out with him at all?
I hung out with him a lot. He was really interesting because he was very, very shy. So him and James kind of became
James
really
also
good,
very shy.
Exactly. But they also shared a love of music, and they loved a lot of the same music. But Cliff was really interesting because Cliff was a big-time metal guy, but he also liked all sorts of different types of music. He loved Waylon Jennings. He loved, you know, classical, just a lot of different stuff.
So R.E.M., I know he was into that.
Yeah, he was a really well-rounded guy in terms of music, which was really interesting because most of the metal people back then were just like, you know, we're only into what we like, and that's it. Nothing. There is nothing else.
That's what I was like.
Yeah.
You can't like Duran Duran or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, I kind of like some of the new wave stuff and a few other things, the punk movement that was here on the West Coast a little bit. So I was kind of not completely zoned
so
in.
Metal, yeah.
Yeah. Iron Maiden kind of changed that, but it's a whole other story. So he liked a lot of different stuff, but super chill guy, really, really smart. I think that's the one thing that people may not get from a lot of the interviews, but incredibly smart guy. I mean, you would sit and talk to him just, you know, not even just about music, but about all sorts of other stuff. And he had really interesting insights and an outlook on what was going on. Really incredibly smart. And he, to me, you know, those first four Metallica records are what they are, really a lot due to Cliff. Because Cliff was the guy that when Lars and James would do something, he would kind of hone it in. Like, they'd take some idea and go crazy with it, and he kind of hone it in and say, no, if we did this and kind of kept it at this level, it would be better. And I think you really can see that with And Justice for All, where that's certainly the most proggy record, because they were unrestrained, so let's write a 12-minute long crazy song.
Oh, so you're saying without Cliff there, then the filter was gone, they could just do what they want,
Exactly. Oh. So I think Cliff had even though he didn't get a lot of writing credits on there, he had a lot to do with the song structures and kind of how things went. You see post Cliff passing away what Metallica was like and what they were like there, and they're kind of different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Cliff had a massive role in that. I know when they were writing and recording stuff, they really, especially James, really looked at Cliff in terms of like, hey, is this okay? You know, how do you like this?
Really?
And yeah, there was kind a of lot of help
up,
there.
Looked up to him sort of thing?
Or, I think so.
As the watermark?
I think so a little bit. I think it was just another voice that he could really trust, because they had very similar personalities and also very similar backgrounds in music as well.
Because it would seem, too, with Cliff being into Waylon Jennings, I know he was a lot into Skinner and the Almonds and that sort of thing, that he probably brought a real sense of melody to Metallica as far as vocal melodies go and that sort of a vibe.
I think so. I mean, look, James is an unbelievable musician, and he's a phenomenal piano player, and I mean, he's a virtuoso for sure. But definitely Cliff there, and having somebody that with, like I said, with that kind of different, a little bit of a different aspect of opinion of music was a really big help there. And just a great guy. I love talking with him. Like, when I had a chance to kind of sit and chill with him, because we could just talk forever about a variety of subjects. That you, like I said, when you're, you know, 21-year-old kid, 22-year-old kid, there's a very finite amount of things you're talking to people about. And with Cliff, it was a whole different scenario. I was like, wow, this is really interesting. You know, he's got an interesting take on everything.
So like, you're talking about backstage at shows? Did you guys ever,
yeah, like, just on the bus or backstage at shows or whatever. So it was pretty interesting. And he, you know, he partied like the rest of us did. But for example, when they were all living in San Francisco, he was still living at home. So we didn't see him as much out hanging with those other dudes, because after a show, a lot of times he'd be like, see ya.
Oh, okay. So did you ever see them at all? I mean, as they grew, you know, from Kill to Ride to Master, and you're still part of the family, right? Even though they never signed to Metal Blade, you're still part of the gang. Did you go see them as they continue to grow and get bigger?
All the time. I probably saw them 20, 30 times on each of those tours as they got bigger.
Was Cliff always the same?
Cliff was always the same. Great guy. I mean, you see, if you look at any of this stuff, you see his dad, Ray, who's like the greatest guy in the world.
He is the best, yeah.
And, you know, Cliff was just like his dad, really never changed, same guy, super chill, just he was the best. I mean, it's so crazy that whole thing happened. When it happened, just everybody's kind of in shock.
Where were you when you heard about this?
Well, I was, of course, here at home in L.A., and this was way before the internet and all this sort of stuff. Somebody from Europe called me. I got a call like 7 in the morning, and it wasn't unusual for that to happen because we had a distribution deal with
Roadrunner.
Because
Metal Blade was really popular and happened in that time,
sure, and too, we had a distribution deal with Roadrunner in Europe and Music for Nation, so I would get these early morning calls because that's how you communicated back then, before computers and everything else.
Yeah.
So I got an early morning call from somebody, and they said, hey, there was an accident last night with Metallica. I'm like, really? And they said, yeah. At this point, it wasn't completely confirmed, but somebody said that it was really bad. Cliff was hurt really bad. That's all we know. I'm like, really? Holy cow. Hmm. And maybe a couple hours later, somebody else called me and said, yeah, he had passed away.
I remember that day, too, because even going beyond that, I read about it in the newspaper. I don't even think it came to pass on TV or anything like that, because Metal was underground. I'm living in Winnipeg, Canada.
Yep.
I remember a little bird blurb, Clifford Lee Burton passed away, 24, and really start crying. Like, you know, crying, 15 years old, I guess I was, almost 16. But I used to hang out with this guy that was a big techno fan. He loved Depeche Mode, and I loved Metal. That was always, like, we were friends. That was always kind of the contention between us. And I'll never forget, he made this really, really, really bad joke. I don't even know what the joke was. He said, oh, yeah. He goes, they got a new song called Trapped Under Bus. Oh. And, dude, I punched him in the face as hard as I could.
Good.
I still remember he had his bus fare, and he fell into the puddle because it was, like, almost wintertime, and lost his bus fare. And I got on the bus and drove away. And he's like, you asshole, I lost my bus fare. And I was just like, I couldn't believe it. Just so sad and so bad, you know. But just shockwaves throughout the fan side of things. What was it like for you guys who knew him?
Well, it was crazy. I mean, you know, you mentioned the newspaper thing, and that's, you know, because I had talked to a couple people beforehand, I mean, you know, when it happened, but really seeing it in press, because it came up, I mean, it was maybe a day or two later, it was in the newspaper, and that's where it really kind of hit home.
Yeah.
It was just like, It's just surreal. I mean, at that point, you know, we didn't really, nobody knew anybody that had passed away from the whole scene. So he was kind of the first big guy, and just, I mean, really just shock. I mean, it's all I can say is just shock. I think for the next 3 or 4 days, I just kind of in a daze. And, you know, everybody's asking, you know, calling me and asking me, are they going to continue? Are they going to break up? Are they going to continue to go on? What's going to happen? I go, I have no idea. I mean, it's funny, I think how those guys think.
It's funny how people think, you know, 3 or 4 days later, are they going to break up? It's like, God, can they grieve and figure out what the hell just happened? You know what I mean? Like, how people actually think about that first.
Yeah, well, they were so huge at that point, you know, and getting really much, really bigger, and their fan base was so insane. I mean, I think, you know, that's selfish on their part, but surely people...
Sure.
But it was, yeah, it was just weird. I mean, I just remember being in shock for like 3 or 4 days and just kind of...
Did you talk to Lars or James at that point in time?
I talked to Lars... Well, they were still over in Europe, so they came back pretty quickly, and then they had the funeral. I couldn't do the funeral. Just
too hard.
Well, number one, it was going to be difficult for me to get to, just for a variety of reasons, and it was I just would have been
not your thing, yeah.
Yeah, it just would have been a bit of a mess. But so maybe I talked to Lars briefly when he got back, just briefly, just say like, yeah, this, you know, this sucks.
What was his mindset?
You know, it's funny, you know, Lars is the businessman. So he kind of, you know, he was emotional, but not crazy emotional, just because I think he was trying to figure out what they were going
to do. Yeah.
So, and I didn't even ask him that. He's just like, thanks, man. It's really terrible. It was a really quick conversation.
Right.
So maybe 2 weeks after that. So this is maybe, I mean, 3 or 4 weeks after Cliff had passed away, something like that. I get a call from Lars. He said, well, we need a bass player. You know anybody? I was like, well, yeah, Joey Vero would probably be the perfect guy from Armored Saint. But they'd already called Joe and he turned it down. Because at that point, Armored Saint and Metallica were still kind of, sort of at the same level.
Which is so incredible to think about, right? Yeah.
So then I said, well, I know this guy, Jason Newsted, who's in one of our bands that would be perfect. And he said, oh, okay, cool. And then,
because Flotsam and Jetsam was a metal Blade band.
Yep. And next thing you know, Jason Newsted is in Metallica.
So you got Cliff in, and then you got Jason in.
I know. Metallica bass player, dude.
But you know what's funny is that the first time I saw Metallica was November 1986, Playhouse Theater in Winnipeg.
Oh, wow.
Which would have been about 6 weeks after Cliff passed away. They were back on stage with Newsted.
So you never got to see them with Cliff?
I never did. And here's the thing. Bad. I had tickets to see him twice. One time, 86, the Vancouver World Expo was going on. And it was Ozzy and Metallica with Cliff. And I had tickets. My uncle was going to take me. And Ozzy got sick that night.
Oh.
And I was so mad. I was like, who cares about Ozzy? Metallica can still play. Can't Metallica still play? So I missed them that night. But it's okay. They're coming back in Winnipeg in November. I got tickets for that, and then he passed away. So I never got to see Cliff Burton.
Well, that's too bad. They were a whole different animal with him on stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love Jason, and he was a great player and a great guy for them, and certainly was the guy in their biggest moments. But, man, that band with Cliff was just a whole different animal, and they just were thicker, heavier, meaner. They were a devastating band from all fronts.
Nobody has played bass before, during, or since Cliff Burton. Like, I've never heard a bass player who plays like him.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, when you listen to Jason playing, he played a lot differently than Cliff did, obviously.
Even just the fact with the pick.
Exactly.
You know?
And Robert, though, plays more like Cliff. And Robert is a great bass player. And he's gone back and he plays, especially that old stuff, he plays it very similar, with a similar sound to the way Cliff did. So it's as close as you're going to probably get.
He's probably the best guy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Here's a question a lot of people ask, and like to ask you, as being kind of in the scene and being an expert, knowing all these guys. How would Metallica have turned out had Cliff not passed away?
I personally think a lot different.
In what way?
I think that, well, certainly they never would have made St. Anger. That is for sure.
But let's not even go St. Anger. You're talking, let's say the Black Album.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting thing. Certainly, And Justice for All would have been a little bit different in terms of him being in there and having a creative say. I think it would have been, even though I love that record, certainly would have sounded better because there would have been bass there. Because the reason there was no bass on that record is you had, as they're mixing it, you had James in one ear, more guitar, more vocals, so the fader goes up, and Lars more drums. So the fader's going up in the drums and the guitars and the vocals, and nobody's touching the bass fader.
Right.
So at the end of the mix, that's what they
and
got.
And also,
basically,
Bob Rock said that Jason's tone was very much the Lemmy Cliff tone, which blurs right in with James's tone.
Well, yeah, that was, I think, a problem when they if you turn the bass up on there, then yeah, the guitars become super muddy.
Right.
So when they got to and look, they knew after they made that record they had to make a change, which is why they got Bob Rock, and he'd done Motley Crue's sure. Dr. Feelgood, which yeah. sounded amazing.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going to make a great record. So Justice for All would have been different. I think it would have been similar to probably Puppets a little bit
mm-hmm.
in some terms. And then the Black Album, you know, I don't know. That's really an interesting point there, how that would have been different. I don't know that it would have been hugely different. But I think that some of the, I mean, it could have even been better, I think, with Cliff there. And certainly the stuff they did afterwards would have been a lot different, I think. But, you know, you never know. I mean,
see, it seems though, too, like
Cliff could have gone down a path of, you know, having them play way different stuff.
But that's what I mean. If you look at Cliff, because we were all real metal in the 80s.
Yep.
Fans and musicians. But as the band gets bigger, and we're talking, Cliff loved Waylon Jennings. He loved the Allman Brothers. He loved R.E.M. He loved classical. That stuff in the mid-90s, when you're talking about Mama Said and Ronnie and all that sort of stuff that's almost had that country twinge, Cliff might have loved that.
It's possible, but Cliff was also about the essence of what the band was and keeping that essence. Like, we are Metallica. This is what we do. And even though he had the outside influences, it was always about keeping that thing real and keeping it what it is. Just like AC/DC sounds like AC/DC on every record. You know, you have bands Slayer, like that, yeah. Slayer. I'm pretty sure that they would not have taken the turns that they did if Cliff was in the band. We'll never know, obviously.
Right. What was the leadership aspect like with Cliff? Was it a three-headed monster of Lars, James, and
Cliff was definitely not a business guy. That was the one thing. He was definitely didn't care about the business, didn't want to be involved in the business. But musically and creatively, it was a three-headed monster at that point, I think, with Cliff there. Because he added, and he wasn't a guy who was going to fight and say, like, no, it's going to be my way. I mean, he could play pretty well between Lars and James in terms of, like, oh, I think this would, and those guys respected him as well. So if he had an idea or said, oh, what if we tried this, they would do it because of the respect factor, because they loved him as a bass player and the creative energy that he brought to it as well. But business-wise, he was not a business guy, so I don't know that that would have.
Did you ever hear the rumor that James and Cliff were thinking about getting rid of Lars on that tour?
Yeah, this is the famous thing in Scott Ian's book.
Right, that Dave said or Scott said or somebody said.
Well, here's the thing about that. I find that absolutely hysterical, because if you know the dynamic within that band, you know, James and Lars are two very, very different people. And they never really, like, when I would go hang out with those guys, for example, I spent 4 days with them in Denver in 1991 on the Black Album tour, and I'd either go hang out with James one night or I'd go hang out with Lars one night, but rarely ever the two of them together. And you know, they're brothers, as we know, but brothers fight and brothers have issues, and I can guarantee you that there were definitely times when they're like, because Lars is, you know, he's got a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's got a lot of stuff going on, and, you know, he's the business guy. And I'm sure there were times when those guys just got tired of it, but they were never going to kick him out. I think those things are kind of funny. I mean, I think, you know, there might have been a minute or two where it's like, oh, geez, this guy's getting on our nerves, or whatever's going on in their world. They might have said something like that, but they would have. I mean, they've been together this long.
Well, especially when you know that, you just mentioned earlier, when Lars wants something done. I mean, he's the guy that was sending out, you know, Metallica press packs to every, you know, Art Shock magazine to get some kind of, or calling you to get a place on the album.
And he's the business guy. Like, out, who's going to run the business aspect?
Where would it have gone? Yeah.
One of the main reasons why they're so successful is he runs the business and knows what he's doing.
Last couple questions. First of all, do you have a favorite memory of Cliff?
Oh boy, there's so many of them. I think, honestly, you know, just I remember one time sitting on the bus, and I can't remember which tour it was, but obviously it was on a bus, so it had to have been down the road. And it was just after a show, and everybody kind of dispersed out. It was just me and him on the bus, and we talked for like 2 or 3 hours, just talked about life and just a ton of different stuff. And that was really the most fun part, just sitting and hanging with him, because he just was such a great guy.
Cool,
so down
to
earth
to.
And yeah, they were starting, I think this might have been, it might have been on the Aussie run when they were doing that with the one that you missed, unfortunately.
Yeah,
might have been on that, but I just remember talking to him for like 2 or 3 hours, and that was a lot of fun.
Your favorite performance of his on a record?
Oh, on a record. Well, see, my favorite Metallica record still is Ride the Lightning, so I think I would have to say probably Ride the Lightning. And live, you know, I saw them play so many times, but I saw them play one of the festivals over in Europe in, I guess it must have been 85, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And they played. I'm trying to remember where exactly. It wasn't in England. It was one of the other festivals. It might have been in. It might have been the Hunt Holland. But he was just, for whatever reason, that day. I actually ended up on his side. I'm always in the crowd. I never like to be on the stage.
Yeah.
So I just in the crowd. I ended up being over on his side of the stage for the most part. And this was when they weren't moving around.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just right in front of him. So I just kind of, for the first time in a long time, just kind of watched him the whole set. Man, just
there's dude, certain incredible. Guys you don't realize how good they are till you see them play live.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he's one of them. Even just watching videos and stuff, just he's always moving. The foot pedals are on and off and that sort of thing. You know?
And he's very subtle because, you know, he let James be the front guy.
Yeah.
But he was doing some amazing things. If you just took a time to watch him for the most part, yeah. It's like, holy cow, this guy is just incredible.
One final Cliff story that Charlie told me, and you might have heard, you might not have, but for everyone listening. So there's a part in Master of Puppets right before the solo where Hetfield says something. Where's the dreams? Laughter, laughter. All I see in here is laughter, laughter, laughter. My cries. Bow, da, da, da. And the solo starts. So Charlie could never figure out what it was. And he said to Cliff, what is he saying before the solo? And Cliff told him, oh, he says pancakes. So every time they would watch the show from the side of the stage, Cliff would look at him and go, pancakes. And now James knows that. And every time they play the big four, when they were doing those, James would always look at Charlie and yell, pancakes. I believe it's fix me. But
yeah.
Pancakes was
it's
the
not
one.
Pancakes. Yeah, I know that.
But it is pancakes to Cliff. So
that sounds like something you'd say. He also had a great sense of humor about as well.
From that, time. Yeah.
Yeah.
A great, great performer. One of the greatest of all time. And much like, you know, Bon Scott passing away and Cliff passing away and the Rev passing away, the bands went on to become even bigger without that guy. But we always wish and you know, wonder what would have happened if they would have stayed. So,
yeah, crazy.
Yeah, Cliff Burton, man. One of the best of all time. All right, the Darkness are back with a vengeance. And here to be vengeful with me, I got Justin Hawkins, man. How's it going?
Good, Chris. Thanks. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. It's funny. I was actually doing some preparation for the first time probably ever in my life, and I read your press release, which you wrote, and it's a exercise in creative humor. It's amazing.
Awesome. I'm glad you appreciate it. Thanks. Sometimes I feel like it's, you know, when you do an album, you have to have an accompanying blurb. I don't know why, but you need to do journalists' jobs for them to a degree, so it seems mad to hire another journalist to do a third journalist job when you can just say it yourself.
Well, and that's sort of the whole vibe of the Darkness too, is you've always had the sense of humor behind you for all this great music that you make.
Yeah, I think it's to be honest, some of the things that we take really seriously are the things that people accuse us of being silly with, and vice versa. You know, it's sort of and I find it really startling when I sort of listen to other people's criticisms of us. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, we were at an award ceremony, and Marilyn Manson was there also.
Mm-hmm.
And previously, like many years ago, Marilyn Manson had said some really nice things about the Darkness. He said something about how great we were or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was a sort of UK journalist that was really sort of probing him and prompting him to, you know, asking him leading questions about us to try and get him to say that we were rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something, he was quoted as saying, oh, bands like The Darkness made fun of Judas Priest, and then people subsequently laughed at Judas Priest, and which is complete nonsense, you know. Mm. Sort of, what we do is celebrating that stuff and actually using vaguely modern influences to sort of try and push it in a slightly different direction. I mean, I think the reason why some people think we're making fun of it is because we don't do it exactly the way it used to be done. You know, we actually try and modernize it slightly, and the things that we celebrate are the more ridiculous elements of it that make you want to aspire to be a rock star in the first place, not the boring stuff, which everyone else seems to think is the important bit.
Yeah, and that's,
you know what I mean?
I don't understand how he would say that you're making fun of Judas Priest when, like you said, if you're looking at what, let's say, a band like Priest was about, it was about costuming and the big stage and that's what you guys started doing in 2003 when you first arrived, which nobody was doing at the time. So I think people maybe thought at first you were taking the piss because it was so different from anything that we've seen in the previous 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, people in glass houses You know, I mean, all that fake blood and gut pantomime stuff. I mean, how, who takes that seriously? I mean, that's got to be a joke, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of...
Absolutely.
The Emperor's, I mean, it's like the Emperor's new clothes, isn't it?
Exactly. But what was the reaction, though, when you first came out, let's say, like wearing a cat suit, which we hadn't seen since maybe Freddie Mercury in like 79 or Steven Tyler or something like that? Did people think at first that it was kind of some kind of a parody or something along those lines?
Well, to be honest, the first time I did the cat suit, I unveiled it in like a really small pub show in East London, really quite a rough part of East London. And, I think there was sort of trepidation within the band as to how that was going to go down. You know, a room full of 15 neo-Nazi right-wingers. and then me prancing in basically some see-through lycra, you know.
Right.
You know, we weren't sure how it was going to go, really. But, you know, I think it was... I think it made them reassess their political leanings almost. And I could feel a... I could feel that I had the power to change people who needed to change, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know, I felt like it was, you know, after that point, we were kind of asking people to make us outfits. And one of the guys that was sort of creating things for me said, oh, one day it'll be like, everyone will be going, oh, what's he going to wear this time? Mm-hmm. And for a minute there, it really was like that. You know, it was actually as much about the clothes as it was the music for a second. Which is probably another reason why not everybody took it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, and combine that with like your crazy falsetto, like such a high voice, which once again, you're thinking about, you know, you mentioned Priest earlier, you're thinking about 80s rock and roll especially.
That guy's got the best scream in rock.
Totally.
We saw him playing in Sweden Rock Festival a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't use it as much as I use mine, but when he does, it's just mind-blowing. Well, I believe he's still got that. You know, it's great.
Well, yeah, and he's also inspiring. In his early 60s or so. So, you know, the fact that he can still pull out those notes when he has to is very amazing, you know, to think about it that way.
Great. It's totally awesome. Great classic songs, really great iconic look, and the voice is still preserved. Amber, it's just beautiful.
Now, is this something for you as a vocalist? You know, you have such a high range, and the melody lines are very high in the Darkness songs. Is that something that ever concerns you to think, you know, 5-10 years from now, if you'll still be able to hit all those notes?
Well, I think 10 years ago, I didn't care.
Right.
And I can still do it now, so it's kind of like I realize that there'll come a time when it sort of becomes more difficult. But, you know, I think that would probably be... If I come down with some kind of serious illness, I think otherwise it's manageable. I mean, it's just natural. It's not like I'm doing anything sort of unholy to achieve that, you know. It's actually pretty comfortable at the moment, so I think I'll be all right.
When you guys were first putting together the whole concept of the Darkness, like we mentioned, it was, you know, the cat suits and the high vocals, and even, you know, your first single, I Believe in a Thing Called Love, had like 4 guitar solos in it. And this is once again in a time when there was none. Was this what you were thinking of doing? Like, we want to just completely change what's going on right now and do something totally different to what's happening?
Well, you know, by the time that single came out, I was 28, so I already felt like I was past it, you know, in terms of past my prime. I mean, there's a lot of people coming through who are 19 or 20, considered the future of rock, and I was sort of resigned to just doing, you know, advertising jingles or some other kind of existence in the music trade.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of decided to just do what we enjoyed doing. Ignore what was fashionable. It wasn't with a view to changing everything. It was more just frustration, and we just didn't want to. We didn't want to play anymore. You know, we didn't want to be part of the scene or try and break through. I mean, back in those days, it's kind of like the main motivation or the main ambition was to be signed to a record label.
Right.
Obviously, that's changed now.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean the same thing. But in the, you know, we're talking about 2000, end of the 90s, 2000, everybody wanted to be able to say to their girlfriend, yes, I just signed a record deal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a professional musician as of today.
It's official
Everything's
now.
Everything's changed. You know, and everybody who's actually been in that situation realizes that That doesn't mean you've made it. It just means that the work has just started, you know. But that was the ambition. Everybody was just trying to jump through the hoops and be the next Radiohead or whatever it needed, you know, whatever it took to be the next big thing, you know. And the darkness happened because we all gave up trying to fit in, you know. Ironically, that was the thing that, you know, just doing that made us into something viable.
But isn't that always the way, though, to really make it, especially in show business or music? You have to do something that's completely different from everything else.
Yeah, or maybe it's that you have to hit rock bottom in order to bounce back or splat on the rocks. Break yourself up over time and try again.
So you've
God knows how many bands we've all been in, you know, interchanging personnel. There really used to be a scene in London. Just everybody moved to London thinking, oh, yeah. It's that old sort of fable about the streets being paved with gold. Uh-huh. And it's just brutal. It really is. So many broken hearts and dreams and stuff. It's just really is an awful business. And, you know, you never know who's going to make it. Nobody saw us coming. That's the truth, you know.
Did you put together The Darkness, or were you gigging with The Darkness for a few years, or was it kind of just like a last-ditch effort, like, screw this, we're just going to do things that we want to do, and whatever happens, happens?
Yeah, it was the second one of those two things. I mean, we played for, I don't know, we were together for about 3 years before we started calling ourselves The Darkness, but I wasn't singing. I was actually playing keyboards and additional guitar. Mm-hmm. And I think we decided to call it The Darkness on the day that I became the singer. To be honest, we're toying with the idea of changing the name of the band, which might be a slightly controversial maneuver at this point.
Change the name of the band now?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But I don't know. We might have to run a competition on Facebook to name the band.
Why is that, Justin? Why are you thinking about changing?
I don't know. It's something that came up. We thought about doing it for this album because it does feel like it's a new, what you might call a return to form. But there's something different about it now. I mean, maybe it's because I know we've had a couple of personnel changes in the last year. It just feels totally different. It feels like it's rejuvenated. And I mean, obviously, it would be career suicide to throw away everything that we've built up over the years. I mean, but there's no reason why we wouldn't be able to. I don't know. Depends. Let's see. I mean, if we end up sort of swamped in debt as The Darkness, then that would be an ideal time to change the name because it would, you know, please us artistically. It wouldn't be suicide. I mean, if in the event of staying together proving to be financial suicide, then it makes sense.
Do you just feel that the name The Darkness doesn't represent your music as well?
Well, it never did. I think maybe it's representing it a little bit too much, you know.
Right.
There's too much of a sense of expectation when you hear The Darkness, and everybody's got an idea of what it is, but nobody really knows apart from us. So maybe it's time to change it. Do you know what I mean?
Do you have any ideas of what you might change it to?
Well, probably got about 2,000 ideas. 1,999 of which are utterly rubbish. I don't know. I really think it's time to open it out, make it. I mean, pretty much everything is kind of, every idea you have is crowdsourced or crowd approved. You know, you need to be addressing what your fans want, because at the end of the day, that's all you got, you know.
Right.
We're not on the radio everywhere in the world, you know. Of course, in Malaysia, we're massive, but we don't spend a lot of time in that part of the world.
Isn't that always the way? Like the most random of countries.
You know, what we're trying to harvest here is like our fan base to have a sense of ownership over what we're doing. And if they name the band, that's even better, isn't it? It's like when you go and adopt a homeless puppy. You know, the first thing you do is you give it a name. That's what we are. We're like the musical equivalent of a homeless puppy.
You're the homeless puppies of rock?
Definitely.
Hey, maybe that could be.
The homeless puppy sort of longingly staring at prospective new owners in the kennel of rock.
Maybe that could be the new name, the homeless puppies.
I love it.
In the kennel of rock.
I don't want to be a the band. Can we just call it homeless puppies?
Even better, homeless puppies. And yeah.
You do realize that puppies is a euphemism for the lady breast.
Well, for bosoms, right?
So maybe that's too misogynist. You know, we're trying to move away from that area.
Yeah, you could just eliminate the middleman and just be the homeless bosoms.
Brilliant. That's even better. Home is bosoms.
I mean, it would be the same idea as what Prince did, you know, 15 years ago when he changed his name just to a symbol.
Yeah.
You know.
But we would end up being the artist formerly known as the Darkness.
T-A-F-K-T-D.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
I'll live with you.
Might not fit on the marquee as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're playing smaller venues these days, and we need to get that printed on a backdrop somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Play big enough places where you can fit that on the backdrop.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned being The Last of Our Kind being a return to form, and I agree with you on that because there was such a long break between One Way Ticket and Hotcakes, and Hotcakes was kind of a different vibe from what Last of Our Kind is.
Yeah. It's funny, we've had a lot of reviews. I mean, obviously I'm not supposed to read reviews. I used to pride myself on not caring.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm super proud of the new album, so I allow myself to read some out of curiosity now.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a lot of them are saying that the last album was a little bit underwhelming. I'll give you an example. Metal Hammer said, this album's a startling return to form. 8 out of 10. The last one was a little bit soppy, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite what... And then, so we went, oh, okay, let's have a look at the Metal Hammer review for that one. And it says, 9 out of 10. There's no consistency. Well, what are the rules, you know?
Yes.
How does it work? If an album's better, then give it a higher mark. 10 out of 10, surely, by implication. That's what they meant. So, in fact, what we've created is the perfect album. Which is the ideal time to change the name of the band, I think. You know, if we're ever going to get away with it, it's now.
It still blows my mind that you're considering that. Like, it's just such a revolutionary thing to do. It's so random, you know?
Well, I used to have this idea with my other band I did in Between the Darkness. I was thinking it would be really brilliant to just have the same album title every time, but then just change the name of the band. You know what I mean?
Right.
We've been like Hot Leg, the Platinum Collection, and then the next year you do another album, and it's... And then Bonjour, the Platinum Collection. Yeah. Loads of Platinum Collection. It's a lot easier for the collection societies to gather your royalties, I think.
Right.
They know what songs they're looking for, you know. I'm not suggesting that all the songs would be the same, but I mean, just the album title.
Yeah, just change the name. Well, once again, you want to do something that no one's ever done before, that would definitely be it. Just change your band name every album.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, because, you know, like you said, right, everybody has the same name but changes the title of the record. You're just flip-flopping it and changing
flip it over.
The band and just keeping the same title of the record.
I mean, everything else in the music industry has been turned upside down. I don't see why this is sacred.
Well, and you kind of came in, you know, mentioning The Darkness in 2003. That was kind of the end of the record-selling days. You know, in comparison to where we are now, what do you think of how things have changed in the business since when you started?
I mean, I feel like it's always, you know, the music trade has always sort of traditionally had this sort of atmosphere around it where it's kind of like a clique that you really need to break into, and only the very select, chosen few
mm-hmm.
Make it, and nobody really understands why those are the ones that break through. You know, there's a million people in the world who are more talented than I am, but they're not in the position that I am and would actually give their right arm to be in the position that I am. And nobody understands what it is. So I think in that sense, the business is the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's never going to change, I don't think. It's just the nature of it. Because I think there's certain things about unquantifiable, unmeasurable things like charisma and stuff that really sort of dictate how much the populace
mm-hmm.
invests in a character or in an artist, you know.
Right.
And to that extent, it's completely irrelevant how good you are. But, you know, I think Tom, who was it now? Todd Rundgren had a brilliant take on it, and I watched some of his seminars that he does at these music trade things.
Mm-hmm.
He said... that in the olden days, music used to be a service that was provided by sort of traveling minstrels or medieval musicians or whatever. And then with the advent of the, you know, musical recording, it became a product which you then sold.
Mm-hmm.
And all that's happened is that because nobody buys records anymore. They only listen to music. Music has gone back to being a service. So all of us musicians are just floundering about, coming to terms with the fact that we've regressed to a medieval state where we're little more than minstrels homing with our lutes and hurdy-gurdies, just trying to make ends meet. The thing is, the shadowy overlords of the music trade, who, you know, used to be the record companies, are still the record companies, which is astonishing, really. I mean, for minimal investment, they're still cleaning up.
And trying to figure out exactly what it is that they do at this stage of the game.
The reason why something like the 360 deal, where, you know, the record company gets your records, they get your publishing, they get your merchandise, they get anything else that you can make money from as an artist, they will take a cut of.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why that is because they want to. It's not because they have any expertise in those areas, because they basically don't. They would be outsourcing that. But I feel like it's kind of like nobody knows where the money is, so they're just sort of chasing it like wolves, really. And instead of trying to create a format, for example, where the experience of listening to music is so beautifully enhanced it can't be compressed into an MP3, you know, and it's completely immersive and groundbreaking. Instead of investing in that, I think they're just trying to find new ways to take money from artists. And that hasn't changed. You know, that's the one consistent part of the music industry, I think.
Yeah,
that's not that I'm complaining. I mean, that's actually, it's awesome. I mean, I actually think that's part of the existence, and it's part of the reason why it's so magical and something that people aspire to, is because it's such an achievement to make any money out of. But it's almost like an audacious thing to try and achieve. And it's been around for hundreds of years, isn't it?
Yeah, to have a profitable tour, if you can do that, it's almost like you've accomplished something incredible at this point.
Yeah,
you know.
Definitely. I mean, you're in a minority if you're making any sort of profit.
I
used to talk about the long tail. You know about the long tail thing?
No, what's that?
Have you ever heard of that expression?
No.
Well, what they used to say was, before the internet, there was a long tail. How do you put it? Like, you've got a graph, and the vertical measurements were, you know, the amount of money made.
Mm-hmm.
And along the other axis, you have bands, you know, so you've got millions and millions and millions of bands. And what used to happen was there was a very steep curve where there were like one or two bands that were making all the money, and then millions of bands that weren't making any money because of the way the music was arranged.
Right.
So the theory was that when the internet came along and all these other smaller bands who weren't making any money had the potential to find an audience without having to leave their bedrooms, the idea was that there'd be more bands at the top end of it making money, and then it'd be a slightly less steep curve. So, you know, the tail would be longer and there'd be more people making money. But what I didn't anticipate is what actually happened, where it became even worse, where there's actually two bands making all the money and then millions of bands are making all money whatsoever.
It didn't solve anything.
It actually just made it a whole lot worse. You know?
It's like a tadpole, and the two bands are the head and the rest of the bands that are making money is the long tail.
Yeah, exactly. A beautiful way to put it.
You
nature to illustrate your point.
See, there you go. We're learning something today on the show.
Yeah.
It's very good. Much like, I have to throw this in there, when I can't remember what song it was. Oh, is it me? Where you said John O'Groats? And I actually had to look that up using the interweb Google machine and found out what John O'Groats was. So you taught me what John O'Groats is, Justin.
Okay, well, I mean, the thing is, John O'Groats and Land's End in that song, those are the two sort of, especially like the two diametrically opposed points of the British Isles, you know? John O'Groats is right at the top, Land's End right down the bottom.
John O'Groats is the furthest north you can get, and Land's End is the furthest south.
Yeah, and it's quite a traditional walking route if you want to raise some money for sick children.
Oh.
Do a sponsored walk between John O'Groats and Land's End. I think that's what Ian Botham did, actually, in the 80s. That's why I know about it, because of Beefy Botham, the famous cricketer.
Just the fact...
He taught me about geography.
See? And then you passed it on to me in the tribe.
Still, look, if you have a moment in the public eye, it's your duty.
He sure is.
Beguile.
And now I shall pass it on to somebody else. We're passing it along today. Now people know, listening to this show, what John O'Groats is.
If they're still awake.
You mentioned reading reviews and that sort of thing. How do you feel when you get a bad review? I mean, we like to say as artists that we don't care, but deep down inside, yeah, it still pisses you off.
Yeah. I'm sure you know what it's like. I mean, it's just... it's hard to explain it, really.
Mm-hmm.
The level of anger. I mean, it's a blind fury. You know, it's just like, it's so, because the first thing you think is, well, who the fuck are you? You know,
right.
And you think like, how dare you compromise, you know, the potential by telling people that something's shit when you obviously haven't listened to it properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, and then it gets worse. And then it's, you know, after the blind fury, you're actually sort of plotting this person's demise. You've never met them before. You know, it's only an opinion. But so unwelcome. It's like, but whereas you get a good review, it's like, oh, this is great writing. This guy's obviously super intelligent.
Yeah, of course.
There's nothing but respect for this writer. Really. We should invite him to something. Yeah. Get him over.
Send him some merch.
Yeah. Hitting off the bottom shelf. That's lovely.
Have you ever gotten any reviews that you remember, just like really bad ones? Do you remember like some of the quotes?
I've got a thing now.
We played a festival.
Bad ones. I mean, the thing is that it does become such a blur. I mean, it really is kind of. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that is part of. I mean, the one reason why I didn't look at reviews was because I wanted to be able to say to people, oh, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't read that shit.
But the real reason why I don't read that stuff is because it makes me so fucking angry. To be honest, sometimes I get more angry about good reviews or even interviews, you know, where if I've been misquoted, that used to be something that really used to send me into a fit of pique. I'd be like, that's not what I've said.
Right.
I'm an intelligent person. You know, that's how deluded I am. I mean, it's been there.
Well, it's also
I can't read anything at all. I just, it's better for me to just pretend I'm not in a band most of the time. It's the safest way.
It's harder and harder, too, though, with, you know, social media and, you know, websites and that sort of thing. It's really hard, you know, if you're on Twitter or Facebook. People are giving you, yeah, their instant feedback on anything. You know, it's like Barbarian, yeah, comes out first single, you're going to hear about it right away, what people think about it.
I think that is great. I mean, obviously, it's brilliant to have a forum where people can talk to each other, but for fuck's sake, don't talk to me about it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Twitter is a one-way thing. It should be outwards, never inwards. Oh, my God, that's awful. It's like opening your front door and then just having a little sleep with the door open. That. Keep away. It's my property, you know. My mind. I mean, it's people are entitled to opinions, but very often I'll get somebody who's tweeting at me and sort of saying, oh, well, I love this, and I think it's really wonderful you've done that. Is there any chance you could maybe do some more like that? Because it's just great, and then I'll just hit block. Silence.
Any type of... Yeah.
In an ideal world, we'd just be making music and then we'd just push it through, you know, it'd be on a very flat format, like perhaps vinyl, and I could push it out underneath the door of my, you know, nuclear bunker, and I'd just stay in there for the rest of the time. Nobody needs to see or hear from me.
Right, no one needs to know. When you...
I'll just send a hologram to do the shows.
Even better.
And, that'd be perfect.
Remember when Ozzy used to have somebody singing for him off stage behind a curtain? You just put the hologram
on. That was a simple rumor, was it not?
Yeah, apparently there was somebody back there doing some background vocals or something. Maybe if that's the rumor or whatever.
Oh, my God.
But you
I have heard that rumor, actually.
You could do that. Just put the hologram up, and then you just sit behind backstage in an, yeah, easy chair and sing the set. You don't even have to put your clothes on. You don't have to put your stage clothes on. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. And then, as I'm sure you realize, when you're seated, you sing a lot better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so you could
comfort that causes, you know, voice problems.
It's perfect. Yeah, you don't have to ride on what were you riding across? A white tiger across the audience a couple tours ago?
Yeah, I've done some white tiger work. I've also done some basic trapeze stuff, and I've had two sort of pivots on my hips so you can do somersaults and play electric guitar at the same time.
Well, I mean, you definitely are a great front man and very, very vibrant and very outrageous, which is why I wanted to ask you about this last tour on the Hot Cakes tour. You actually went out with Lady Gaga. Which a lot of people were kind of saying, I don't get it, but I totally get it. I mean, it fits perfectly, her vibe and your vibe, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think the timing of it was something that a lot of people didn't understand, because it was, you know, the Hot Cakes album came out, and then the first thing we did was we went on tour with Lady Gaga. I think ideally we would have done some of our own shows. But when, like, the biggest tour comes along and invites you on it, then for me, I don't think it's something you can actually turn down. You know, we're actually playing playing to full stadiums in South America, and we'd never been to South America before, because nobody ever sort of gave us the opportunity to do that. And when we sort of broke through, you know, you go where the records are selling, and I think there's such high saturation of piracy down there.
Right.
And they never used to send us there back in the day. So we've always wanted to go, and then this gave us the opportunity to sort of make some inroads in what we consider to be one of our most important territories, you know. So it was great. I mean, just on that level, going to places that we hadn't been before was awesome. I think there were some, how do you say, correlation between her approach to a show and ours. I mean, obviously hers is, you know, benefited from hundreds of millions of pounds worth of investment, whereas ours is just four blokes joining in. But I think it was great. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it, and the experience was just really, really exciting for me, I thought.
How did that come to fruition?
Just that I got a phone call just out of the blue. Well, from our US manager, who said, you know, there's this. And I was like, well, brilliant, let's do that. You know, we were actually looking for a support to her. But we sort of anticipated it might end up being someone like Aerosmith or Lenny Kravitz or someone like that, who was doing, you know, big arenas at the time. And we were hoping to get on something like that. But then Lady Gaga was obviously, that was the thing that was selling the most tickets and had the biggest buzzy thing. So we decided to go for that.
Well, and I mean, did she give you the opportunity to do kind of your full show, or did you get to use any of your effects or anything like that?
No, but she gave us a reasonable time slot, though, you know, like a 45-minute.
Which is great, set, yeah.
There was no need for her to do that, but she did, so that, we're really grateful for that. I think bringing our show to that thing would have been a little bit inappropriate, maybe a bit presumptuous. I think we're... You know, there's a certain etiquette to being a support band. You try and keep out of everyone's way. You know, you don't want to be setting fire to stuff and flying above them.
Right.
Keep yourself to yourself.
How did you go over in front of her fans?
It depends where we were, actually. South America was brilliant. Parts of Scandinavia was just mind-blowing. France was truly one of the greatest things I've ever experienced. We played at the Stade de France, which is obviously a football stadium, and it just felt like a darkness show. I mean, I know, obviously that's an awful thing to say, awfully ungrateful thing for a support man to say, but we had a great time. But then, you know, there were some times when it was stony-faced. they call them little monsters, who were just sort of like staring at us like we were from a different planet, a planet which is inhabited by... I don't know, animate dog shit men who are just repulsive to look at. And I don't know, it just didn't work in some places. But I think overall, like 75% of it was brilliant.
I think that was the quote of the talk so far. Animate dog shit men.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, there's a film in there somewhere. We might have to change the name of it. But
there might be. You could throw that in the hat for the new name of The Darkness as well, maybe.
Yeah. That's a reanimate dog shit, man.
How is it being in a band with your brother? I mean, over the years, we've seen from Ray Davies and Dave Davies to the Robinson brothers to the Gallagher brothers fighting and arguing and screaming. Has it ever come to that with you guys? It seems like you guys are getting along pretty good at this point in time.
Yeah, we are having a good time with the brothers element. think it's just maturity, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all these bands get together, get back together eventually, no matter what they've been through, because of the brothers thing. It's one of those relationships where, have you got brothers?
No, I don't. I'm a dreaded only child.
Oh, cool. Well, when you have a brother or sister, it's one of those relationships where you've got a peer who you can basically treat like shit and always know that they're coming back, you know.
Right.
It's a little bit like a marriage, but without the possibility of divorce. So no matter what you do, this person will always be your sibling. So I think when you're working with somebody like that, it can actually be really damaging. You can end up sort of really upsetting each other. And it can take years to repair, but it always does. That's mm-hmm. the point.
mm-hmm.
Eventually you realise how to sort of nurture it in a more productive way, but it does take time and it takes maturity. And you've got to not take each other for granted. So I suppose it's like any other relationship, only a little bit more indestructible, maybe.
Did you guys used to jam together when you were kids?
On and off, yeah. I think mainly because we come from a small town, so there wasn't that much of a music scene. So if there was a band happening, most of the time we were both in it. our tastes are very different. And obviously there's the brothers thing. So sometimes we did and sometimes we didn't. Depending on who said the most upsetting thing.
Yeah, of course. Now, you mentioned before, I mean, obviously, you know, the Hawkins brothers have been the cornerstones of the darkness, but you've had, you know, Frankie's been in, Frankie's been out, and then Ed is gone, and then you had Emily come in, and now you have Rufus Taylor playing with you on drums, who's, you know, obviously Roger Taylor's son. Now, I'm assuming you're a huge Queen fan just by your vocal stylings and some of your stuff that you do as a frontman. Would I be correct in that assumption?
Yeah, my left hand has the original members of Queen tattooed on each finger. Starts off with Brian. Freddie's on the middle finger, of course. The ring finger is actually Rufus's father, which is a little bit awkward when he first walked in. And then John Deacon's on the pinky. I thought I'd put him on the small finger because I know that he doesn't like the public eye so much. I very seldom use that one when I'm playing guitar, so just touched my way there. Yeah, I'm a massive Queen fan. I think, to be honest, it's I don't really understand people who aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I don't know, I think through that, you know, passion for Queen, and that's obviously been acknowledged by the Queen people. We actually became really good friends with Brian May. And I've even shared an evening of debauchery with Roger Taylor. I was very lucky to do that years ago. And I feel like that's actually how the opportunity to work with Rufus came about, because one of their people spoke to one of their people, and we made it happen, you know.
Right.
I actually have supreme confidence that Rufus is going to be our drummer for many years to come now. He's awesome, and he's such a great person. Really, really fun to hang out with. Completely gets it, and he's more rock and roll than anybody else we've met. So.
It's in his genetics. You know, I saw Queen...
Well, I think it's funny enough, I actually do believe that there's something in there. I think he's completely booked and equipped for this lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And knows exactly how to have a good time without f***ing everything up. You know? It's just brilliant.
I saw him play last year with Queen. He actually plays some drums in their set now. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was him, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, as luck would have it, our schedules permit him to do both things this year, so
mm-hmm.
there's no reason for him to have to turn anything down at the moment. He's just going to be busy for a while.
What's the reaction in England? I mean, The Darkness is a very English band, as is Queen, and now, you know, Queen with Adam Lambert as the singer, who in America had a really good name value and actually does a hell of a job. You know, you can never replace Freddie, but as a singer and as he has that vibe and that, you know, his sexuality is the same as Freddie. So how was the vibe in England?
I don't think anybody's sexuality is the same as Freddie's.
Well, but, you know, he's gay as Freddie is, so at least he can pick up that vibe. Like Killer Queen, he embodies that same vibe. What is the thought process in England? Do you guys know who Adam Lambert is? Do you even give it a shot, or is it like Freddie or nothing?
I worked with Adam on his first album, actually.
Oh, that's right. You did. You wrote a song with him.
Yeah, the first song on the album is one that I wrote.
I remember that.
So I've actually, I don't know whether I'm a good person to ask for you. I've been aware of Adam since the beginning, really. there was a moment in the series when he performed with Queen, and it was quite obvious from the way Brian May was looking at him that he was going to do that job at some point. I mean, everybody saw it coming.
Right.
Everybody who was aware of that show saw it coming. And I think he's the best man for the job. You know, he's definitely got what it takes, hasn't he, in terms of vocal range to be able to pull off the more ambitious Queen tracks. And I think Paul Rodgers was. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest singers ever, but he is limited to a certain type of rock and roll, which means that a lot of the Queen catalogue gets left behind when you use somebody like that. But that isn't the case with Adam Lambert. I mean, he's obviously got much more diversity in his performance style, I think, to be able to do all the really challenging arrangements.
Well,
I don't think it's got anything to do with his sexuality, I must add. I actually think it's more to do with his larynx.
Well, I agree with you on that, but I think that the sexuality adds to it. I mean, I think...
all right, maybe from a sort of PR perspective, it's a good way to sort of address the usual sort of American concerns that people have about sexuality. You know what I mean? Like, it was a long time before actors became openly gay in America, I think.
That's true,
That's the perspective. That's the sort of perception that you get from English people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in England, of course, we have people like Elton John who are openly gay, and not only that, they're knighted. They're knights of the realm. The Queen has laid a sword on his shoulder and made him one of hers. And I think that's a vastly different attitude, you know. The sexuality thing isn't something that English people ever consider, really.
I think just from a show business standpoint is what I was saying, though. He has that flamboyancy. Yeah. That you would have from being, you know, being gay as Freddie was. I don't think I don't think it's like, you know, if you're taking the top 100 reasons why Adam is a great singer in Queen, it's maybe, you know, number 100, but I think there's a little element to it where he can really feel some of those vibes. That's just the way I kind of saw it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think he's, you know, if he's ready to embrace that side of it, that's really cool. But I do think that Freddie was, you know, he's one of those people who subverted macho culture in the way he was wearing. Like, he was probably one of the first a pioneer of that, really.
Sure.
All that leather stuff and, you know, wearing the Marlon Brando hat, and I don't think anybody ever made that association with gayness until later, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the fun, really. So, I mean, it's hard to find areas where you're actually challenging in the same way nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably part of the reluctance to accept Adam as a Queen singer. So they never actually bill it as Queen. They always bill it as Queen with Adam Lambert.
Yeah, Queen plus Adam Lambert, okay. Exactly.
I think they're quite smart about what they're doing. And you know, they're definitely using the right guy, and they're not cheapening the catalogue by actually getting out there and playing. I mean, God, I mean, who would begrudge them the opportunity to go and play those songs at this point in their lives? I mean, it'd be sad if they weren't allowed to, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, those songs would never live again. You know, at least played by the original guys. You know, do you know
Did hear Kanye doing Bohemian Rhapsody recently?
No, he didn't.
Startling. Door dropping.
Diabolical.
Breathtaking.
Do you know that today is the 30th anniversary of the Queen Live Aid performance? Which has been,
is it really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I just read that when I was waiting for you to call, and I was like, how apropos. Yeah.
Today's today.
Yeah, today, man.
Yeah.
Voted the greatest gig of all time.
I came out of podcast retirement in honor of that.
Just for that. That's the reason, right? That's why you booked it today.
Yeah.
Well, you guys have a huge tour coming up of the States starting October 9th in California. And how long has it been since you guys played in the States?
I think last time he came was 2013.
Okay, so it's been...
It last time, around about May or something, we actually played at a festival in New York called the Great Googa Mooga Festival. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not.
It was a food festival, primarily, with music as an afterthought, which is the kind of thing that we love to do. The boutique festival, which is more about food than music.
Music's the afterthought.
I know. Let's get the darkness.
Perfect.
Yeah. There was some really great falafel and guitar solos. Brilliant. But that was, around about May. So it's been the last couple of years.
Okay.
It's been a bit year.
So, I mean, do you look forward to touring the States? Is there a different vibe here than there is in England? Are the venues similar sizes?
Always look forward to. I mean, I think actually it does vary from town to town. I mean, obviously it's a huge place. It's more of a continent than a country, but which makes it, you know, challenging and hard work to get across, but it's totally worth it. We've got some amazing fans in America, and we're looking forward to playing for them again, you know.
Will you have some production?
I particularly like LA. I mean, that might be a controversial point of view, and I know it's sort of a bit of a cliche, but I love walking around LA. I think it's great. And I can see myself living in Philadelphia. I've got some great friends there. Love Seattle and all the bits in the middle. So, you know.
You could actually walk down Hollywood Boulevard in your cat suit and no one would even give you a second glance.
I've tried that, and they do.
They do?
Second glance.
They do? Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not that.
And somebody shouted, hipster, for a passing car. I didn't actually know what that meant at the time. I was quite flattered, but then I realized that it was intended to be an insult. It quite hurt.
Well, the tour is coming up, and I want to ask you a final question. Actually, twofold. What's your favorite Queen song, if you had to choose one?
What a difficult question. It would be something off. Sheer Heart Attack, the album. Mm-hmm. Probably in the Lap of the Gods, as opposed to In the Lap of the Gods Revisited. I think it's part of a. It's difficult to listen to it on its own because it segues into another song. But some amazing singing, actually by Roger Taylor.
Who's a great singer. Yeah,
In the Lap of the Dog. Gods, that was a Freudian slip.
Which would be another one. I just discovered the Prophet song. Like, I mean, I'd heard it, but you know when you hear a song that you hadn't heard for a while and you rediscover it, it's like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's like, it's such a great tune.
Have you ever tried the delay vocal bit in the middle? Have you ever tried achieving that yourself?
Impossible, you know.
I used to do it in sound check. I mean, it comes a point where you can't do the harmonies and stuff, but
right.
It's really satisfying to try and pull that off.
Yeah, if you can do that.
At least.
I've done okay with Bohemian Rhapsody.
Everyone should try it. It's great.
Yeah, if you have that range, for sure.
And a delay pedal.
Yeah, you need that, yeah. Last question. What's your favorite Darkness song to play live?
At the moment, it's Barbarian from the new album.
Great tune.
It has. Because now I do both the dramatic monologues in it, one in the beginning and one in the middle. I get to scream that chorus, and I get to play the guitar solo. And it's about Vikings. And who doesn't love Vikings, apart from the people who are being raped and pillaged by them? There comes a time when you've got to forgive and forget, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, besides those sad sacks, Vikings are pretty damn cool.
Yeah, great look. Iconic. Seafaring people as well. You've got to respect that. I mean, of course they were naughty boys. But, I mean, you know, got to break a few eggs if you want to make a Scandinavian omelette.
Justin, it's great talking to you, man. I appreciate you taking some time as you enjoy your leisurely walk home in Switzerland from the Thai food restaurant. And
when I was heavy breathing earlier, it wasn't because I was masturbating while we were speaking, although you are, you know, it was because I was going up a hill, and it's hilly.
It's not because not because of my ruggedly handsome looks. It's because you're walking up a hill.
It's a bit of both, if I'm honest. But right. Don't want you to think that I was exposing myself to this.
All right, man. We look forward to seeing you in the States. And actually, our band and your band is doing a festival together in December somewhere, Winter Rocks or something in Sheffield. So
amazing.
Fantastic. I'll come and say hi to you.
Great stuff. Look forward to it.
Thank you, my friend.
Thanks a lot, mate.
All right.
Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Thanks to Justin Hawkins of The Darkness. They're kicking off the Blast of Archon World Tour next Friday, October 9th in Pomona, California, just outside of Los Angeles. The Darkness put on a hell of a show. It's super entertaining, so much fun. Cat suits, giant inflatable penises, huge high screams, guitar solos. What more do you want, man? Actually, it's funny. Justin does a spot where he stands on his, he does a handstand and claps with his feet. You know, like, clap, 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 but he does it with his feet. Super funny. You're going to find out all the tour dates and ticket information about the upcoming tour at thedarkness.co.uk or on their Facebook page, which is The Darkness Official. If you haven't seen The Darkness, you need to go. And if you haven't picked up The Darkness's new record, Last of Our Kind, it harkens back to the Permission to Land record. Very, very cool. I am really digging it. I'm a big Darkness fan. I have been for the last 10, 12 years. And Last of Our Kind is a return to rock and roll form for the band. You won't be disappointed. You can get it on Amazon, and if you do, please use them TIJ links. You know where to find them. Go to podcastone.com, click on the supporter show sponsors banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got them Amazon links for the USA, the UK, the Canada A. Every time you use the TIJ Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. Now go ahead, order yourself a killer rock record and support Talk is Jericho in the process. Both The Darkness and I thank you. Or go buy some Metal Blade records. Go buy King Diamond or Slayer. Buy Master of Puppets so you can listen to the greatness, the brilliance of Cliff Burton. Thanks to Brian Slagle for telling us all about Cliff. And thanks to all of you for sending them great emails to my email address, talkisjericho@gmail.com. Got another couple to share. Scott in Montreal wrote, how about getting the last piece of the original lineup of Kiss? You've had Ace, Paul twice, Gene, of course, Bruce Kulick, just missing Peter. Can we expect to hear that one? I would love to have the Catman on Talk is Jericho. I just got to track him down. I don't have any contacts for Peter Criss. Is anyone's listening out there that wants to help me out? Find me Peter Criss. I need him. Scott continues. He's just finishing up his first 6 months of DDP yoga. He's lost 25 pounds so far. Another 15 to go for the target. Keep rocking, Scott. You're going to make it. Joseph wrote in from Brisbane, Australia. I'm curious to know what the story is behind the controversial music video for your song Enemy from All That Remains. The video shows a wheelchair bound man struggle to get up a flight of stairs only to jump off the roof at the end when he gets there. That was the director's idea, and it was a little bit morbid, and that video was banned from MTV. It came out the same week as Jay-Z was in a video where he got shot and there was like blood all over the place and blood pellets and bullets, but our little video was banned because a guy threw himself off the roof, I guess because it was suicide. I'm not really sure. So you can ask the director. His name was Paul. I forgot what his last name was, but whatever. Cool video. I like it. I like the feel of it. Actually, the guy taking pictures is Fred Corey, the drummer for Cinderella, who I saw at AC/DC in Los Angeles the other night. One more question from my email, talkisjericho@gmail.com, from Aaron Kersey in the UK. Love the show. My favorite episode has to be William Shatner. Intelligent intellectual. Look forward to seeing you and Fozzy in Birmingham in December. Well, William, actually, a little bit of a treat for you. He will be returning to Talk is Jericho very, very soon. And I will be returning to Madison Square Garden. October 3rd, the 25th anniversary of Y2J's wrestling career. It's going to be amazing. Jericho versus Owens for the Intercontinental Championship live on the WWE Network. 25th anniversary, the exact 25th anniversary. So come check out my 25th anniversary to the day. And come see me become possibly the 10th time Intercontinental Champion. I have 9 Intercontinental Championship victories. This could be number 10. It's going to be a huge night, a great celebration with Don Callis, Cyrus, Jackal, whatever you want to call him, the network guy from ECW. Lance T. Storm will be there. Dr. Luther is going to be there. It's going to be the 25th anniversary of Chris Jericho. Very, very fun. Then I head to Saudi Arabia October 9th. Head over to Mexico October 16th, October 30th. Rocking the Kiss Cruise with the Kiss Navy. And, of course, Paul and Gene and the boys. Then the Cinderblock Party goes back to the UK and Europe with Nonpoint and Sumo Psycho in tow. November 26th at the Islington Academy in London. That's one of the big shows. So many big shows. Go to FozzyRock.com for all cities, venues, ticket information, VIP information. Don't miss out on meeting me and the rest of Fozzy. We are going to have a good time. One last thank you to all the Talk is Jericho supporters, all my sponsors. Really appreciate all you guys being with me. Next week, I'm going to tell you all about the Y2J 25th anniversary, a special edition with Don Callis, Lance Storm, Lenny St. Clair, Dr. Luther. We're going to be talking all about the early days in Calgary and Winnipeg, training, early days in Japan. The 25th anniversary week of Chris Jericho starts next week. I'm so excited to have you guys along. Thank you so much for joining me. Thanks to Justin Hawkins of The Darkness. Thanks to Brian Slagle. Thanks to Cliff Burton. We'll see you next week. Peace, love, and hugs on Wednesday, Jericho's 25th anniversary. You're not going to want to miss this show. A big thank you and a big yeah boy to all of you.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.